have you ever eaten something and it didn't taste like what you expected? That's probably true for many of you, right? After coming back from COVID, my taste and smell were affected, and so that's kind of true for me with everything. Things don't quite taste the same right now, and it's starting to come back. But you especially have occasions like that when you go to a foreign country and you eat foods that maybe you don't know what it is because there's a language issue, or maybe it's just not quite what you expect, or something like that's not prepared the same way. Well, about 12 years ago, almost exactly, because I was there over Christmas, I went to Thailand. When I was there, there were three boys from our youth group and three girls from our youth group who went there. And we served with a missionary and his wife that our church had a connection with. And we went all the way to Chiang Rai, Thailand, which is in the far north of the country. And we were there for a period of time serving and helping the ministry with various things among the tribal groups there in northern Thailand. But when we first got there, we went to dinner with the missionary that our church knew and his wife. And his wife is native Thai from Thailand. And he had grown up in Thailand as a child because his parents were missionaries there in Thailand. And we met with them, and they had ordered for us already when we got there to the restaurant because we didn't speak the language. They did. So we got there. Food was out there. And I knew what rice was, and I knew what cabbage was. Everything else that was out there, I didn't know what it was, didn't quite understand what it was, didn't really care what it was because it smelled good, and I'm kind of an adventurous person when it comes to food. So I was the guy on the trip that they pushed to the front of the line whenever we went into a village because they would always give us some kind of something to eat because to welcome us, and most of the times we had no idea what it was, and I would be the one that would eat it because I was the most adventurous. And a few times I ate something and it was terrible, but I said it was good because I didn't want to offend them, and then also I wanted everybody else in my group to think it was good and they would eat it as well, and then I got to see their reaction. So I so anyway, I didn't quite do my job the way that the rest of the kids in the youth group wanted me to do. But when we got to this restaurant, one of the dishes had these little bits of green pepper, and they were probably, I mean, it was diced, so I don't know what kind of pepper it was, and it was the biggest piece were probably a quarter of an inch. That was the biggest pieces, but mostly, I mean, they were just really, really tiny. And so I didn't think much about it. So I got a little of everything on my plate and was ready to eat, and we prayed. And now, unknown to me and to the guys, so the three guys on the trip, we were at one end of the table. It was a long table. The other end were the three girls and our chaperones and the missionary couple. Well, one of the girls who was with us apparently started getting this dish with the green pepper and putting it on our plate, and the missionary wife stopped her, and to quote her exact words, she said, "No, no, what you do, you breathe fire like dragon." And so she didn't take any of that. Now, I didn't get this memo, and the guys with me didn't get this memo. We didn't hear her. So one of the guys, he didn't get any of the food because he was on a self-proclaimed no green diet because he was a good red-blooded American and he wasn't going to be caught dead eating vegetables. So Thailand was tough for him for multiple of reasons. He most of the funny stories involved him and food. But anyway, so I got this food and so did the guy next to me, and we started eating. And if you know me with food, I jump in zealously and I just start eating the food really excitedly. So I did. I started eating my food, and at first, things were great. Everything tasted good. The food tasted great. But then this tickling sensation kind of started in my throat, and I thought, oh, this has a little bit of spice, but, you know, that's okay. I like mildly spicy things, so I was fine. Well, a few seconds later, this tickling turned into a fire, and it went straight down and hit my stomach, and then it went straight up and went to my throat and then across my tongue, and I started drooling like crazy. My lips turned bright red. My nose started running. My stomach turned into, it felt like a rock. I thought I was going to throw up and explode all at the same time. I thought I could breathe fire like a dragon. So the missionary wife's description was quite accurate, and I, boy, it I mean, I thought I have made a serious mistake with eating this food. And so I took my glass of water, which, by the way, I learned there and that in other countries, their big serving size of a drink is our small size. So I had a cup that was about this tall, and that was it. So in two gulps, I had my water drank and done with, and that didn't even touch the spice. So then I also learned at that time that in other countries, you don't have automatic free refills. You have to make a separate drink order, and most people don't do that. So I'm trying to get the waitress's attention to get more water because I think I'm going to die if I don't get more water. Well, meanwhile, the kid who's next to me, he's also eating the same dish. And he is, he wants to have a more macho appearance than me. I didn't care that everybody knew I was in pain. I was just trying to get the spice down. He didn't want to admit it. So he was sitting there with his jaw locked and his nose was running. And so snot was coming out and I could see his lips were starting to turn red. And so I knew he was hurting, but he wasn't going to admit it. And so I asked him, I said, are you okay? Do you need your water? And he was like, and so I just took his water and I drank his water for him. And so then we were both without water. So anyway, long story short, I was still dying. The water never got there. I figured out that cabbage, if I put that in my mouth and started chewing on it, that helped a little bit. So I ended up eating like half this bowl of cabbage. And so basically my whole meal was cabbage at that point. And I ate a bunch of cabbage and the spice went away and I survived. But I did not expect those little green peppers to pack that quite big of a punch. And I probably only had a couple little pieces. And I still have no idea what those peppers were to this day. If I was an explorer, I would have named them the dragon pepper for obvious reasons. But sometimes we get into cases where things don't quite go like we expect, maybe with food or something else. And I think the first Christmas that we celebrated yesterday, the very first Christmas, a lot happened that people didn't expect, that the Messiah would come and that he would be born in a manger with a bunch of animals, and that he would be born to two unassuming Jewish people. A lot didn't happen like people expected. And I think in many ways, Jesus' second coming, there's a lot that we read when we read prophecy in the Bible that we don't quite understand, and things are happening like we don't necessarily expect. And I remember the first time I heard about the Millennial Kingdom and was reading that. Probably the first time I was exposed to it was the Left Behind series as a kid when I was reading through that, and I thought, what in the world is this stuff? And I was completely confused about it. And I think when we study end time stuff, there's a lot that confuses us, and because things aren't happening quite like we expect, or things may not happen like we expect, we kind of give up and we decide, I'm not going to try to study this stuff. I'm not going to try to figure this out. Let's just go on to something that I understand, or let's just skip this and move on. So today, I want to talk about Jesus' second coming, and we'll finish our study in Zechariah. Today, we're going to see what we can expect from Jesus' second coming. This is not all-encompassing. This is not going to deal with everything with end times. This is going to deal with Zechariah 14, where we're going to be, if you want to turn there, and we'll see what Zechariah reveals about the Jesus' second coming in the Millennial Kingdom. So we're going to finish. This is an oracle in Zechariah. We started 2 weeks ago. We're going to finish the oracle today to finish off in chapter 14. And today we're going to see four things that God will do if you're following along in your sermon insert outline, and then something we need to do looking forward to the new year. So four things God will do, and then what we need to do in response to that. So if you would turn with me to Zechariah 14, I'm going to read just the first eight verses to start, and we're going to break this chapter into sections, and we'll kind of talk about what's going on here. The first point I want us to see from all of this, before I read, is that God will return and deliver his people in a dramatic way. That's something we saw last week. But we're going to see that God will return and he will deliver his people in a dramatic way. Let's take a look at this. Zechariah 14, verses 1 through 8. It says, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half of the city shall go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from their city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half of the mount shall move northward, and the other half southward. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountain shall reach to Azal. And you will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. On that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost, and there shall be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening that time there shall be light. On that day living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea, and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in summer as in winter. So we see that God will save his people when he physically returns to earth. So we're starting this passage where we started a couple weeks ago with the Battle of Armageddon. That's the battle going on. That's the siege that's going on with Jerusalem. So we've kind of moved backwards from 13 where we were. We've moved back to the Battle of Armageddon, and we're in the middle of that in this conversation. In verse 1, we see that the nations will take spoil from Jerusalem and will sit in security, and they will divide up the spoil amongst one another. They will feel victorious, and houses will be plundered. So the Battle of Armageddon doesn't go like the armies gather against Jerusalem, and the Lord says, okay, now that you're here, I'm going to come back and eliminate the armies here, and you're not going to harm a head of my people, a hair on the head of my people. God lets these armies come, and they do a number on Jerusalem and a number on the people there. There's pillage, there's raping, there's destruction, there's death. All of that is going to go on for a period of time, and the nations will feel victorious. And a large part of Jerusalem, at least, will fall and be destroyed. And that, all this, again, is a part of the Battle of Armageddon. Half of the city will be removed from the city, either as those who have fled, so they fled the city and run away, or those who have been captured, not sure, but they're outside of the city, they've been defeated, and they're losing the war. After this, Jesus will physically return. He'll return from heaven to the Mount of Olives, the very mountain that he stood on when he ascended. Now, I have a few pictures here that I want to show you. Okay, good. I can see on here. So what you're looking at here is obviously Jerusalem. These are pictures that I took from Jerusalem, so the quality isn't as good as if it was professionally done. I'm standing. I can't quite remember what I'm standing on. It's a building of some sort. But what you're seeing is, you see the Dome of the Rock there, obviously, in Jerusalem now, which would have been where the temple was, the Temple Mount. And then what you see, you kind of see that steeple that's on the back hill there, that church-looking building, and then that ridge that's back there. All of that, that elevated area in the back, that ridge, is the Mount of Olives. That's where it is. And so we're looking over the Temple Mount, looking towards the east. So the Mount of Olives, I always pictured it before I went to Israel as like a mountain, right? So a pretty rigid, small mountain. It's really kind of a ridge. And if I remember right, it's about 2 miles long. So it's kind of a long ridge there. If you want to go to the next picture. Okay, you see it there. There's the Mount of Olives. You can see the very southern edge of the Mount of Olives there at the edge where it looks barren, and that's because there's a lot of graves there. It's a graveyard there at the edge of the mountain. And if you want to go to the next picture, I think this is the last picture. So now I'm down really close to the Kidron Valley there, and you can see the Mount of Olives, the graveyards going up. I think where the city is, I think, is a separate mountain, a separate hill. But I'm down where, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, the old city, so close to where the city of David would have been when David was dwelling in Jerusalem. I'm about at that elevation, I think, right side of an excavation that they're still working on. But anyway, looking up at the Mount of Olives there. So that's the Mount of Olives. If you want to go back one picture, Dylan, I'll point some things out there. So I wanted to show you that so you can kind of visualize this, and I think it'll help when I'm talking about this. So one thing that's interesting to note about the Mount of Olives is you trace in Ezekiel, because of Israel's sin and their constant rebellion, Ezekiel has a vision where the presence of God, which was dwelling in the temple, which would have been roughly where the Dome of the Rock is, that gold-domed building, is now present day. In the Holy of Holies, the presence of God was there, and Ezekiel has this vision where the presence of God, because of Israel's sin and rebellion, leaves the Holy of Holies. It goes eastward, which is towards the Mount of Olives, so the same direction my camera is pointing. It goes across the Kidron Valley and ascends the Mount of Olives and is gone. The presence of God is left because of Israel's sin. Well, then, when Jesus comes, and we celebrate on Palm Sunday, when Jesus comes into Jerusalem, where does he come from? He comes from the Mount of Olives, right? So God in the flesh comes from the Mount of Olives and goes into the Eastern Gate, into the Temple Mount there. That's where Jesus comes in. That's how he comes. And, of course, Jesus was rejected and crucified, and we know that. And then Jesus' ascension, we see in Luke 24 and Acts 1, Jesus goes to the Mount of Olives, and he ascends someplace there. There's like three different churches that claim this is the spot where Jesus ascended on the Mount of Olives, and I'm not sure anybody knows for sure because they don't know where Bethany is, and that's roughly where Jesus ascended. But wherever Bethany would have been on the Mount of Olives, Jesus ascended from there into heaven. And then we're told in Acts that the same way that Jesus ascended is how he is going to return. So then we see here in Zechariah that Jesus, the Lord himself, will come from heaven and will stand on the Mount of Olives. Somewhere on there, on that 2-mile ridge, is where Jesus is going to come back. And I think that's pretty cool that we can see that. And when I was standing on the Mount of Olives, I was thinking, man, like I could be in the very place that Jesus, this is where he's going to set foot on the earth again when he comes. But anyway, I wanted to share those pictures with you so you can kind of visualize what's going on. And what we see also is that when Jesus returns at some point, there's going to be a split in the Mount of Olives. It's going to split in half. One half is going to move to the north. One half is going to move to the south. So that would be like this direction. So I'm looking to the east. So there would be a split. Where that's going to happen, not sure. But I think it's got to be close to where that view is, because it's got to be close to Jerusalem. Because what's going to happen is this new valley that's going to be created is where the residents of Jerusalem, who are under siege from the armies of the nation, they are going to flee through this valley to Azal. Now, nobody that I read knows where that is. I don't know where Azal is, but they're going to flee through this valley and flee and escape the armies of the nations who are pillaging them, who are attacking them, and who are defeating them. The ESV that I just read from indicates that Jesus will come after this fleeing from Jerusalem, after this splitting, because in verse 5 it says, "Then the Lord my God will come." And that's an interpretation of a conjunction in Hebrew. King James says, and the Lord will come, so it doesn't include a time element here. Either way are normal ways to translate this conjunction. I'm not good enough at Hebrew to know if there's something indicating that there is a time element there with this conjunction. So, but either way, either if Jesus comes and stands on the Mount of Olives, then there's a dividing of the Mount of Olives, or there's a dividing and then Jesus comes, I'm not sure. But either way, Jesus is coming back. Jerusalem will flee. The residents of Jerusalem will flee through this valley, and Jesus will return before or after. In verse 6, we see that on the day of the Lord, there will be no light. Now, day of the Lord, again, I talked about 2 weeks ago, can refer to several different events. And it could be that this is referring to when Jesus comes back for the millennial kingdom, or this could refer to the events in Revelation 22 on the new heavens and the new earth. I'm not sure, because in Revelation, if you study that, you see a lot of crazy stuff is going on in the sky with things falling out of the sky and disturbances in the heavens talking about the sky. So I'm not sure for sure. The context here is the millennial kingdom, but I could see it lining up with the new heavens and new earth. But the ESV reads that there's going to be no light, and then there won't be any cold or frost. Now, this is an amended reading that comes from the Greek translation of the Hebrew. So if you have a different version from the ESV, it might read differently. And that's because the Hebrew is really difficult to translate. Hebrew, this is what it says. It says that the first half, it's clear in Hebrew, just what the ESV says, that there's going to be no light. But then the second half in Hebrew says something about the noble ones or precious ones congealing. So this kind of shows what I think about candy. But the image that pops into my mind at this moment when I think of precious ones congealing is a bunch of gumballs or a bunch of jawbreakers or malted milk balls. If you have ever put a bunch of those in a container and it's been exposed to heat or moisture gets in there and you leave it for a long period of time, they kind of congeal, right? They kind of get nasty and meld together. And so these precious ones congealing, that's the difficulty, is what are we talking about when we're talking about precious ones congealing? ESV decided the Greek translation of the Hebrew, which decided it was talking about cold and frost. They went that route. The NET Bible translates it this way, and I prefer this translation. It says, on that day there will be no light. The sources of light in the heavens will congeal. So we're talking about the sun, the moon, the stars, so that the things in the sky that put off light, somehow they're going to be darkened. Something's going on there. And I think that's what's going on. I think that makes sense with the first half of the verse. So if you have the HCSB, the NRSV 2020, or the CSB, they translate it in a similar way. So you're seeing that instead of the cold and frost that the ESV has it. So all that to say, I don't get into that just to get technical. But what I think this verse is communicating is that on the day of the Lord, there's not going to be any light coming from the sky, from the sun or the moon or the stars. It's going to be a unique day, it says, whose timing and details are known only to God. It's a mystery that God knows about. There won't be any distinction between day and night. And when evening comes, there will be light. But the crazy thing about that is evening is when the sun goes down, right? That's when you wouldn't have light. So there's not going to be light. There's not going to be distinction between day and night. And then at evening, normally when the sun would go down and there isn't light, there's going to be light at this point. So where's this light coming from? I'm not sure. If you link it to Revelation 21 and 22, we see that on the new heavens and the new earth, and what we see, I believe, in what Dylan read as well, that Jesus himself, God himself, is the source of light for creation and for the world. You don't need sun anymore. God himself is the source of light. How that works, I'm not sure, but that's what's going on. Maybe that's what's going on here, is that the Lord himself is the source of light. Again, are we talking about the millennial kingdom context? That's kind of the context we're talking about here, but maybe Zechariah is skipping ahead and thinking about the new heavens and new earth. But either way, there's this day coming where the lights in the heavens are going to be darkened, and it's going to be a unique day where there's not this differentiation between day and night, and then at evening there's going to be this light that's coming from somewhere, I suspect from the Lord himself. So even the very cycle of day and night are going to be disrupted. In verse 8, we see another wonderful natural phenomena that Jesus' coming is going to result in. We saw this in what Dylan read for us today in Ezekiel and Revelation, is that there is going to be a new river that flows from Jerusalem to the Western Sea, which is the Mediterranean Sea, and to the Eastern Sea, so that is the Dead Sea. So it will flow from east to west. If you're thinking back at the picture, this is going to flow from the Temple Mount, so it's going to flow towards kind of what now is the Mount of Olives, and then also back towards where I was taking the picture from, towards the west, towards the Mediterranean Sea. We're told in Ezekiel 47 that this river will make the Dead Sea, which, by the way, the Dead Sea is 8 times saltier than the ocean, and I've been in the Dead Sea before, and it feels like warm baby oil. It's really weird, and you're in it, and you can float. You can almost sit straight up in that water because of how salty it is and how much you float. But the Dead Sea is going to become fresh water, and there's going to be fish in the Dead Sea, which right now there's nothing living in the Dead Sea. That's the name Dead Sea, right? So this water is going to revive the land. It's going to revive, even the Dead Sea is going to be full of life. We see in Revelation 22 that Dylan read that this river has the trees of life on either side of the river. And these trees of life, this is the same tree of life that was in the Garden of Eden, right? And so that's going to be there. The leaves are going to be for the healing of the nations. And I believe that this all is literally going to happen. So there are some that take all of this stuff as symbolic with the rivers and everything. I think, especially because in Zechariah, you've got all kinds of stuff being talked about topographical changes to the land. You've got specific landmarks being mentioned. This is a literal river, and literally these things are going to happen. All these things are going to happen when Jesus comes back to usher in the millennial kingdom. So the very face of the land itself is going to change to usher in a blessing on the land, a blessing to the people of Jerusalem. There's going to be a river that bursts forth from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, flows to the east and west. There's going to be that special day where there's no light from the sky yet in the evening, when normally there's darkness, there's going to be light. Jesus himself is going to return. The Mount of Olives is going to split. So all this extreme natural phenomenon is going to happen. Let's look at verses 9 through 15. It says, after all these things, the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. The whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hanal to the king's winepress. And it shall be inhabited, for there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. And on that day a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of the one will be raised against the hand of the other. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold and silver and garments in great abundance. And the plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, on the mules, on the camels, on the donkeys, and whatever beasts may be in those camps. So what I want you to see from these verses is not only will Jesus deliver his people from the battle of Armageddon, but Jesus will reign from Jerusalem over the whole earth and will glorify Jerusalem. Jesus is going to reign in Jerusalem during the millennial kingdom, and he's going to bring glory not only to Jerusalem, but to the whole earth. Now we see in verse 10 that the river flowing from Jerusalem, that's going to be possible because we see that the whole land around Jerusalem that was allotted to Judah, the tribal allotment of Judah, will be turned into a flat plain. But Jerusalem is going to remain elevated. So if you go to Jerusalem today, it's on a mountain, it's on a hill, and there are other mountains, like the Mount of Olives. There are other mountains all around it and valleys. It's a very hilly area. All of that is going to be made flat, except Jerusalem is going to remain aloft. And so if you know about water, the way that it works is it goes downhill, right? So if there is a river that bursts forth from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is aloft and everything else is flat, that's how this new river is going to flow. It's hard to imagine if you're in Jerusalem now. There are valleys. You could see how a river would flow in different directions, but to see how it flow exactly the way that this is describing would be hard to imagine now because of the mountains that surround Jerusalem. But all that's going to be made flat at some point after Jesus returns. And so we see these, again, this natural phenomenon going on, and Jesus is going to do this, and he's going to reign from Jerusalem. Why? We see because he is the king over the earth. People from around the world are going to come to Jerusalem to worship him. So it'll be apparent to most of the world that Jesus alone is God. It should be apparent to the whole world at that point, but it's going to be apparent to most that Jesus alone is God. He can and will deliver his people because he's the creator. And we see here, again, we're going back to the Battle of Armageddon, that Jesus is going to destroy the nations, the armies of the nations who are attacking his people. And he's going to keep Jerusalem safe. So there won't ever be a decree of utter destruction on Jerusalem ever again. There won't be wrath upon Jerusalem because of its disobedience. Jesus will be there. He will keep Jerusalem in security. He will protect his people from danger, internal or external. Nobody can overthrow Jerusalem because Jesus is there protecting them. And this will be a great blessing to Jerusalem because I have no idea how far in the future, whether it's near or far, that all of this is going to happen. But we do know from history past all the way to the present day that Jerusalem specifically has been a war-torn place. Israel and Jerusalem specifically have experienced conflict after conflict, war after war, maybe yet more in the future. But when Jesus comes, that's going to end. Jerusalem is going to finally have peace once and for all. It'll have peace. It will dwell in security. The people there will dwell in security. In verse 12, we see here some kind of graphic imagery of what's going to happen to the nations who are attacking Jerusalem. The Lord will strike all the enemy armies with plague. If you think COVID's scary, wait till you see whatever this is. I don't know what it is, but it's going to cause. In verse 15, we see this plague is not only on the soldiers, but also on their livestock. Their eyes are going to rot. The tongues are going to rot in their mouths. They're going to decay from where they stand, and they are going to die, obviously, because of this. And this plague and what's going on is going to cause chaos amongst the armies so that they turn on each other and fight each other. That's a strategy that God has used before in the Bible, we've seen, against the armies attacking Israel. And the armies will destroy itself and will die because of this plague. And Jesus will reign victorious over these armies. And then after that, the spoils of the nations will be available to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem will pillage the defeated armies. So instead of Jerusalem, so this chapter started in verse 1 with Jerusalem being pillaged and the goods in Jerusalem being divided up amongst the armies of these nations. In the end, after the defeat of these armies, after they've been destroyed, then the plunder of these armies will be divided up amongst the residents of Jerusalem. They will have the spoils of the armies of the nations. So Israel will take the wealth of the nations, really just like they did back in the Exodus event when they took the wealth out of Egypt when God delivered them from Egypt. God will deliver them from the nations, and they will take the spoils of the nations. Third point I want us to see today, third thing that the Lord's going to do is that the Lord will be worshipped by the whole world. The Lord will mandate worship for himself, and the Lord will be worshipped by the whole world. Saw this in verse 9 most prominently, but we can also see it in verses 16 through 19, which I'd like to read at this point. Verses 16 through 19. It says, "Then everyone who survives of all of the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. And if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up and present themselves, then on them there shall be no rain. There shall be the plague with which the Lord afflicts the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. And this shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths." All right, so in verse 16, we see that not all who belong to the nations who oppose the Lord, so these nations who are attacking God's people in Jerusalem, not all of them are going to be destroyed. The people who are going to be destroyed are among the armies who are attacking Jerusalem. But people who are back home and wherever nations they're a part of, they'll survive. They're not going to be destroyed. God's not going to just snap his finger and wipe out all the nations who oppose him here. The armies will be destroyed, but not all the people in the nations themselves. So the survivors then, who are living on earth around the world during the millennial kingdom, they will come to Jerusalem every year to worship the Lord and keep the Feast of Booths. Now, what in the world is the Feast of Booths? The Feast of Booths is a feast that was commemorated and commanded of Israel in Leviticus 23, Numbers 29, and Deuteronomy 16. So this feast commemorated the fact that Israel dwelt in booths. Now, what's a booth? It's a temporary dwelling. So kind of think about camping. That's what I think of when you set up a tent or something. It's a temporary dwelling. It commemorated when Israel was fleeing Egypt and dwelt in booths as they were fleeing Egypt. And then also, we see that it was a celebration for the harvest and for how God provided for his people. We see these things in Deuteronomy 16. And so it was kind of a Thanksgiving celebration, both for what the Lord had done for Israel when they were fleeing from Egypt, and then also for the provision for each year that the Lord had provided for their crops. So that was the Feast of Booths. It's from the Old Testament, from the Pentateuch. We see that commanded of Israel. Now the awkward question, probably what you're thinking is, why in the world does the millennial kingdom, which has the risen Christ reigning there, why do they have an Old Testament Jewish festival day? Because as Christians now, we are not commanded to do the Feast of Booths. So if you like to camp, you missed out on your chance to do church camping, I guess. But in the future, that will happen. Why? Well, I don't think anybody knows 100% for sure, but it is interesting to note that the Feast of Booths, what you see even in the Pentateuch, even in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, is that the Feast of Booths was a celebration not just for the Jews, but for the God-fearing Gentiles who were among the Israelites. So even if you were a Gentile and you wanted to worship the Lord, the Feast of Booths, that was something that you were to celebrate, you could celebrate, that you could be a part of. So it's interesting that that was the case then, and then going on into the millennial kingdom that will be full of people worshiping the Lord, not just Israel, but from nations around the world, Jews and Gentiles. We have this celebration of the Feast of Booths that in the past were for Jews and Gentiles as well. It could be, we see in verses 17 through 18, the talk of drought and all of that, that could link the Feast of Booths to, again, the same reason it was celebrated in the Old Testament among the Jews, where it's almost a Thanksgiving celebration, a thanksgiving to the Lord for him providing food and crops and the basic necessities of life. That could be the case. It kind of links the two, drought and then the blessing. But then it also could be, I suppose, just as Israel celebrated their deliverance from physical bondage in Egypt, it could be that the nations of the world come before the Lord to celebrate in Jerusalem because of their liberation from spiritual bondage through Jesus' death and resurrection. That could be the case as well. Not exactly sure, but what is clear is that that's going to be a requirement in the millennial kingdom, is celebrating the Feast of Booths every year. And any nation, we see, that does not go, in verse 17, we see that any nation or people that does not go to celebrate the Feast of Booths, that does not go to worship the Lord for whatever reason, they are going to suffer drought and they are going to suffer plague as a result. In verse 18, we see that Egypt is singled out. Why Egypt is singled out, not exactly sure. Maybe it's because Egypt is the nation in the future that is not going to do this, because when you see God give a warning and a punishment for something, what you saw in the Old Testament was that was there because eventually God's people were not going to do what they should do. So it could be that Egypt is going to be the nation or the first nation that does not go and worship the Lord as they are supposed to for the Feast of Booths. But it could also be because Egypt has the Nile River. And the Nile River is a source of irrigation for the nation. So as long as the Nile has water, Egypt, especially at this time, would do pretty well with their crops. So this could be, Egypt could be singled out because they're saying, look, even if you're a mighty Egypt, you got a mighty river, and you think, you know, we can survive even with a drought. We don't have to go worship the Lord. That everybody is going to suffer. It doesn't matter if you have a mighty river or not. You're going to suffer consequences. You are going to suffer from a drought if you don't go worship the Lord. That could be the case too. I'm not exactly sure why Egypt singled out, but either one of those I think are good options. But anyway, in the millennial kingdom, everybody in the world is going to come worship Jesus from all the nations. It's a requirement. You go worship the Lord. You celebrate the Feast of Booths. If you don't, there's going to be plague on your nation, there's going to be drought on your nation, and you're going to suffer as a result of that. Jesus is king. No longer is the dispensation of grace where we're in now, where people can blaspheme the Lord and not worship the Lord and ignore the Lord and not necessarily suffer direct consequences here on this earth. That period's done in the millennial kingdom. If you disrespect the Lord, if you're not going to go worship the Lord, if you're not showing up to worship like you should, you're going to suffer drought, you're going to suffer plague. Jesus is king, and the world should know it, and the world better act like Jesus is king, reigning from Jerusalem. The fourth point I want us to see comes from verses 20 through 21. And that is that the Lord will make all of Jerusalem holy. I'm going to read that for us here. So no longer will Jerusalem be a rebellious or a despised city, kind of like it's been throughout history. It will really be holy. Look with me at verses 20 through 21. We'll finish Zechariah 14 here. It says, "On that day there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. And the pots in the house of the Lord shall be as the bowls before the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holy to the Lord of hosts, so that all who sacrifice may come and take them and boil the meat of the sacrifice in them. And there shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day." So what we see in these verses is that even the animals used in Jerusalem will be holy, and the pots and the bowls used in sacrifice will be holy to the Lord. There will be nothing defiled or pagan in Jerusalem. The ESV says there's not going to be traitors any longer in Jerusalem. And if that's the correct reading, then that's indicating that no longer is there going to be a vested interest in commerce as far as the temple worship goes. So we see that that was a problem in the temple, especially even in the time of Jesus. We see Jesus overturning the tables in the temple because people are buying and trading. They're defiling a place of worship with their focus on making money, making it a place of business. So if traitors is the correct reading, then that's what's going on here. Is no longer are there alternative reasons for being in the temple. It's all about worshiping the Lord. Now, another reading, and most of the other versions read like this, so if you have a different version, it probably says this, but instead of traitors is, no longer will there be Canaanites in the temple. And if that's right, I wouldn't necessarily see this as something literal. And by the way, in Hebrew, the same word can be Canaanite or traitor, so both of them are legitimate translation options. But if Canaanite is the correct reading, then I don't think this is saying that there is going to be nobody of an ethnic group from the Canaanites that will ever be allowed in Jerusalem. I think this is referring to the Canaanite pagan religious practices, that the idol worship and things involving their religious rituals and the unclean animals and all of that, none of that is going to be in Jerusalem anymore, which is really had been a part of Jerusalem really since its founding and since David took it. All of that was kind of present there still in Jerusalem throughout the years. And so when Jesus comes, all of Jerusalem will be holy, and none of that's going on. So either way, if it's a traitor or we're talking about Canaanites, either way, there's going to be nothing unclean, nothing defiling, no ulterior motives to being in the temple of the Lord. It's about Jesus. It's about worshiping him, and the entire city and all of those there, even the animals, even the pots, all of it is holy because Jesus himself is there, and he has made it all holy. That brings us to our application today. So this new year, look forward to and celebrate the peace that Jesus will bring at his second coming. So look forward to and celebrate the peace that Jesus will bring at his second coming. People have different responses to the new year. So you have some people who are very optimistic. I mean, they love New Year's time and not just celebrate and change their calendar and all that, but they think, you know, every new year, boy, that's the year that they're going to make it, and they may have had a tough year this year, but the next year, that's when things are finally, the stars are going to align for them. It's going to be a great year. It's going to be a year of blessing. So you have the optimistic people. Then you have the pessimistic people, and I think that number has just risen with the COVID pandemic and that kind of thing and the inflation that we're experiencing in our economy and everything else, is that these people think, well, 2022 or whatever new year it's going to be, they think it's just going to be worse than the last year. It's going to be just as bad. I'm not going to celebrate. It's just going to be a terrible thing, terrible year. That's the pessimist going into the new year. You have both of those responses. Now, as Christians, we know that 2022 is going to go just as God plans it to go. That's true both globally and for us personally in our own personal life. It'll likely be filled with both blessings and trials, just like every year is. But we also know that it's possible that each new year, each new day, really, could be the start of the day of the Lord. And I talked before about the day of the Lord not necessarily being one day. We're talking about end times. So 2022, I very much believe that end times, the beginning of end times are imminent. It could happen at any point. And so 2022, very much so, could be the year that the end times start. Now, not the millennial kingdom, because again, as I said last week, the millennial kingdom is not where Jesus coming to the Mount of Olives and all that is not where the day of the Lord, the end time stuff start. There's a tribulation that has to happen beforehand. I tentatively believe in a rapture beforehand that kicks everything off. And so there's a lot of things that have to happen before the millennial kingdom. So 2022 is not going to be when the millennial kingdom happens, but it could be the year that all of this stuff kicks off, that the Lord says, you know what, enough is enough. I'm wrapping this thing up, and we're going to get started with judgment and all of that stuff. And as Christians, again, we know who wins in the end. We know the ending of the story. We know that all this heads to the millennial kingdom, and not only the millennial kingdom, that's not the ending point, but after the millennial kingdom, there's the great judgment, and eventually, with the new heavens, new earth that we saw in Revelation 22 that Dylan's read, is that there will be no more death. Death is destroyed. Sin is destroyed for good. Evil is destroyed. Satan is removed forever from the earth. And that's our great hope as Christians, is that no longer will there be anything evil in creation. We will reign with the Lord forever and ever in eternity. And the start of that move to eternity could well be 2022. So as Christians, when we're entering a new year, we need to not only look forward to maybe what blessings we might receive in 2022, if you think it's going to be a great year for you and embrace whatever the Lord has for you, trials and blessing, but we also look forward to maybe, just maybe, this next year is the year that the Lord is going to begin the day of the Lord. He may return for his saints. He may start the tribulation. We may start the movement towards the end times. And that's something that we should celebrate. We should be celebrating, kind of like Craig talked about, we can celebrate Christmas year-round, and we really should. We can year-round and all the time be thinking about the blessing, and it really should be at the forefront of our minds, what we're striving towards and we're living in light of, the second coming of the Lord and all the blessing that's going to come with that. That should be something that keeps us moving. No matter what trial, no matter what tribulation, no matter what fears we have of coming ahead, we know that in the end what's coming is the Lord Jesus and all the blessings that he's bringing with him for his saints. So we've seen today that God will return to the Mount of Olives to deliver his people in a dramatic way. Jesus will reign from Jerusalem over the whole earth, and he will be worshipped by the whole world. If anybody doesn't worship him, if they decide they're not going to do that and they're going to rebel, there's going to be negative consequences for that nation. There's going to be drought. There's going to be plague. Because of Jesus' presence then in Jerusalem, all of the city of Jerusalem will be holy. So this new year, what we need to do is we need to look forward to and we need to celebrate the peace that Jesus will bring at his second coming. Don't just look at worldly blessings that you may receive this new year, but be looking forward to the spiritual blessings that we'll all receive when the Lord returns, whether we're living when all this stuff starts or whether we are in heaven awaiting for the Lord's return and the Lord to usher in the final days. As Christians, we always have a reason to be optimistic about the future. We know that in the end, the future is that the Lord reigns from Jerusalem. We know that in the end, the Lord reigns over the heavens and the earth forever and ever, and we will be a part of that. And that is our great hope, and that should always be something that we're remembering, especially looking forward to a new year and years ahead. Let's close in prayer.